Electromagnetic fields are all around us. They're a force of nature generated in the fluid outer core of the Earth's crust by electrical currents that flow in the slowly moving molten iron and extending out into space for more than 30,000 miles. Migrating birds use the Earth's electromagnetic field to help them navigate, and some fish have specialized organs that sense electromagnetic fields to help them detect the presence of predators. These naturally occurring fields have been around since the Earth was formed. But over the past 150 years, humans have figured out how to create their own electromagnetic fields, electricity generation and distribution systems, including those big power lines that crisscross the nation, the emergence of electronic devices like radio transmitters and radar, and now personal electronics like mobile phones have all contributed to a dramatic increase in our exposure to electromagnetic fields. But is human exposure to all this electromagnetic radiation safe? That question is one that Dr. Andrew Marino has been studying for more than 60 years. He is a retired professor in the Department of Orthopedic Surgery, Neurology, and Cellular Biology at Louisiana State University Medical School, and the author of many books, including Going Somewhere, The Truth About a Life in Science. Doug and I had the great pleasure of speaking with Dr. Marino last week, and we asked him to begin at the beginning. Here's our interview with Dr. Andrew Marino.
60 years ago, when I was a first-year graduate student in physics, I had the phenomenal good luck to meet a brilliant man, one of the greatest scientists of the last century, in my view, a guy named Robert Becker, who was at the crust of his popularity in science because of his new and revolutionary ideas regarding growth control, healing. He was an orthopedic surgeon, and he asked the simple question, how do bones heal? What starts it? What controls it? What ends it? And what tailors the bone at the end so you don't even know it was fractured if everything goes well? How does that happen? And he would look me in the eye and say, Marino, it ain't biochemistry. It's something more. It's electromagnetism, electromagnetic energy. It's signaling. It's a growth control process that's run by electromagnetic energy, the only force in nature that can act at a distance. He got a lot of grants. He was really hot. He wanted a physicist to work for him. My mentor at the university made a deal. I did my research in that lab and got my PhD doing it, the studies that helped to further explore Becker's theories. I got my PhD and stayed on for 12 more years. Becker didn't want to commercialize his ideas until he had evidence that there would be no harm. That was the first rule for a physician, do no harm.
Yeah.
So he assigned me the job of testing whether electromagnetic energy had any adverse consequences. I set up animal studies. I found adverse effects. We told the government and we told industry about them. Industry told us to go to hell. We didn't know what we were talking about. That was no way to talk to me. And the rest of my life went in that direction. That's how I got started.
So what kind of effects did you find that you didn't expect to find?
When one designs an experiment looking for effects, one starts with a definition of something that's going to be measured, the independent variable in the study.
Right.
I picked substances in the blood, weight gain, fertility, things that I could measure.
Right.
And I'm planning to say that there's a possible health risk to human beings if the things that I measure are affected by the electromagnetic energy I'm applying. That was my experimental plan. And I did it over and over and over again, published article after article after article, became absolutely convinced that in fact, the body does detect this energy, and hence it's possible a risk and it should be studied further, and people should be taught about the possibility of a risk before they make decisions about being exposed, living near high voltage power lines, for example.
So electromagnetic energy exists in the natural world, right? I mean, we are all electromagnetic beings to a certain extent. We have electrical systems inside our body. How is man-made electromagnetic energy different from naturally occurring electromagnetic energy?
The second part of your question is mostly inaccurate. We are not electromagnetic entities. We are biochemical entities. That's okay. The doctrine today. Don't ever lose sight of that, because that determines everything in this area. There's some electrical processes that go on, but that they're well understood, very simple and very straightforward. It's the passing of nerve pulse from a sensory organ like the eye or the touch or the nose or the tongue to the brain. And that's it. That's the extent that biochemists are taught about electromagnetic energy. If you look at the education that biochemists get, you get a PhD, they get no physics. They know nothing about electromagnetic energy. And physicians, they learned only a little bit about a little bioelectricity and zero about electromagnetic energy running the body. So the last part of your question, I can't agree is an acceptable way to...
He can't answer it because it's not a good question. It's, okay. It's not based on facts, Doug.
Okay, fine.
Now, the first part was great.
Okay.
And let me answer it this way.
Sure.
From the beginning of the universe, I don't know, 15, 18 billion years ago, from that time on forward, including the evolutionary period for man on Earth, okay, there was an electromagnetic environment that was determined by the magnetic field of the Earth and by cosmic sources. That was it. All of the evolution took place in the context of the magnetic field of the Earth and cosmic sources of energy, which run every frequency interval, low frequency, high frequency, very high frequency, ultra high frequency, as well as zero frequency. Beginning in the 19th century, man began manufacturing his version of electromagnetic energy. Now, the frequencies he used and the intensities of these frequencies, how strong they were beaucoup greater in strength than anything that ever existed before. So it's a completely alien environment for animal life. It began with Marconi and with Edison. So it is something new on the face of the earth. And then when the cell phone came along, it got even newer, because instead of the typical sine wave, now we have very complicated structures of this. You can't say it has this frequency or that frequency, because it doesn't wave. It's pulse. It's a completely different signal. Humans were never exposed to that, anything remotely like that. So first part of your question was a good one, and the answer is straightforward. It's entirely novel in the human time frame.
So what sort of symptoms does exposure to this electromagnetic energy trigger in humans and in other animals?
Only God knows. only God knows. To relate a symptom to a stimulus is an incredibly fortunate event and rarely happens. You had a heart attack.
Yeah.
Something caused your heart attack. What was it? That's the answer to your question. There are no symptoms. There are only health risks, because the entity, the man-made entity, is biologically active. It matters to your body, unlike, for example, the color of the shirt that you have on. It's blue and green. You wouldn't expect that blue and green is safer than red and white in your shirt color. There's no reasonable link between the color of your shirt and a potential for disease. Not true with anthropogenic electromagnetic energy. Since when we put it on animals, it affects animals. And since animals are physiologically, well, they're not identical to humans, but they're the best thing we have for studying it. If you do that or you do nothing, it affects animals. And it affects animals and produces a variety of different effects, depending on what you choose to measure. And it has a particular effect on the stress response system. And for my money, that's the mechanism that connects chronic exposure to man-made energy, electromagnetic energy, and human disease, and overtaxing of the stress response system.
Can you define the stress response system?
The stress response system is a fundamental characteristic of animals and humans, and it consists of a biochemical axis between the brain and the adrenal gland. It's a hormonal system that protects your body against insults. When you're cold, it turns on a shiver response. When you are warm, it turns on a sweating response. And it protects in a million other ways. And it does that by sending hormones through the body, well-characterized hormones, to turn on the response system, the detection system. The fact of the matter is that that system is limited. If you get one stressor, for example, cold, the system is working to protect. If you get another stressor, like say, poor diet, the system again is stressed. If you get another stressor, for example, a toxic chemical at low levels that doesn't produce any obvious symptoms, but still taxes the body, these things are cumulative, and they reach the point for each individual where a breakdown occurs and a disease develops. What disease? Any disease on earth. It depends on your genetic composition, what you're exposed to, and a myriad other factors.
And the timing of the exposure.
Absolutely. And the strength of the exposure and the other exposures in your environment. This was a theory that was developed by a very famous man named Hans Selye. A very famous man was denied the Nobel Prize because of prejudice that came from the United States mostly. And at that time, every other nation's research was following the United States. The United States was king of the hill at that point. This is post-World War II. Hans Selye stayed in Canada, ran a clinical system for protecting against stress-related diseases, but never went any further than that. Was not funded by American grant funders because the nature of what research ought to be was already set in stone by the most powerful man in American history, in the politics of science, in the post-World War II era, a man named Philip Handler, the man who is the subject of my present book. Mm. He looked at everything as a purely reductionistic biochemical system. He had no truck whatsoever with phenomena taking place at the system level. If you couldn't design an experiment based strictly on biochemistry, then you weren't going to get federal research funds. And that's the rule today.
I was just going to say, I don't think anything has changed.
Right. And I'm hopeful that this guy who just took over, as weird as I think he is going to change that. He recognizes that among myriad things that he doesn't recognize.
All right. So you've been testifying for smart meter legislation, is that correct?
In a roundabout, teeny little way, yes.
Teeny little way, okay.
I testified once regarding smart meters. In my career, I've testified, I don't know, in the area of electromagnetic fields and the possibility of a health risk. I've testified 100 times. In all of these times I've testified, power frequency, cell phones, other sources of electromagnetic energy, I testified once regarding smart meters. That's what I mean. It's the tippity-tip-tip of the iceberg. And the smart meters are coming, and no force on Earth is going to stop them, just like no force on Earth is going to stop cell phones. And the people who are sensitive to electromagnetic energy in the environment are simply going to have to tough it out until they can find a way to use political power to get some form of justice. The fact is, the science that Handler handed us at the end of his term, he was 12 years ahead of the National Academy of Sciences, the system that he set up in cooperation with industry was that anything industry wanted to do, it ought to be able to do, develop technology, advance the economy, create jobs. And there is no pre-market approval necessary at all, like for a drug. None, nada. That was his idea. And of course, industry loved him for it. It was exactly what they wanted. And he got that system instantiated in our country. So now, unless the product has acute significant and obvious consequences, which allows a plaintiff to go into court under a tort theory and collect injuries. There are no rules at all. And I don't know. I'm not taking any position about that. I'm just telling you about the reality of it. The thing that really annoys me is that the government does not tell the public the truth in its stark significance. We do not know whether cell phones cause brain cancer or not. Maybe they do, maybe they don't. That's the truth. Tell that to people and let them do what they're going to do. I certainly don't want to have rules saying you can't make cell phones. Tell people the truth in its stark significance. The government doesn't do that. Why? Because the government represents all the people, you, me, and the people who run industry.
I was just going to say, in the industry guys, right?
Yes. And the people, and those guys don't want the truth and its stark significance told, so the government doesn't do it.
So, Andrew, you seem to be pretty skeptical about the scientific world. I mean, you know, we rely on scientific studies in our work to try to educate the public about various kinds of environmental exposures and, you know, how they may be harmful to our health. And when we see a preponderance of studies that demonstrate a causal link between an environmental exposure and some sort of biological response, which, you know, could be a precursor of some serious health concern, you know, we feel like the public should be aware of that risk.
Look, science has three personalities. One is an intellectual activity. That's the activity of the mind. And God, I love it. I think it's wonderful. And I've rejoiced in it. And I'm so grateful for having learned the rules that exist in that area and have had the opportunity to test them and apply them and extend them. But it's an academic activity. Academic activities, by and large, in this world, are not funded. Who the hell is going to pay for an academic guy to go in there and pursue his academic ambitions? Science is an expensive proposition. Mm. Who's going to pay? The only people who have money are industry. And the government and the military. Now, the folks, the scientists who work for those three are de facto compromised. They owe a loyalty to their employer. The law requires them to be loyal to their employer. Now, they are going to do anything they can to support their employer. Not you, their employer. So the idea that science somehow has got a carved out group of people who are interested in the truth is a figment of the imagination. It doesn't exist. The third aspect, the third personality, in addition to science as a tool for those three entities, is the fact that it's an adversarial process. When I went into court and testified that electromagnetic energy from high voltage power lines was a health risk, and I was representing a plaintiff who was complaining that her illness was related to being exposed to very high electromagnetic fields from the power line. Power lines carry energy. Most people think the energy is in the wire. It's not. It's outside the wire. It goes to 300 or 400 or 500 feet on either side. So if you're living near a power line, you're living in this flow of energy 24 hours a day, 7 days a week for your whole life. Boggles my mind how people can blunder into that and still do it. Anyway, my point was that there was a causal relationship between exposure and the cancer that was developed in the client. On the other side, sitting there were 10 guys with suits, ties. One was from NIH, one was from Harvard, one was from Yale, two were from Stanford. Every one of those guys got on the stand and said that everything I said was a pile of crap. None of those guys had any experience. By that time, I had published many papers in this field. I knew every worker in the field. I knew it upside down. That's what I learned. I had to take a different tact, and I did.
So let me ask you this. Are you optimistic that science may eventually find its way? Are we going to be stuck in the handler version of science for the rest of all time?
Well, let's put it this way. For my lifetime, and for your lifetime, and for halfway through the next century, was stuck with Handler. I'm writing the book now so people can understand how the hell we got here. If you don't understand how we got here, you're going to have no motive to get someplace else, to see what you missed, to see what's wrong. So I'm hopeful at the end of this century, well after you and I are pushing up daisies, I'm hopeful that it will be read and understood. At least that's my shot at immortality, and I'm going to do it.